This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. This week, we'll hear from one of the candidates running for Illinois governor, Sam McCann.
Neither party really cares all that much about the people of Illinois. Each party exists for the same reason, and that is to amass more and more power.
McCann is a state senator who is running on the Conservative Party ticket. Our interview with him later this hour. Also, with all the talk of renewable energy, what about nuclear power? More on how the state's nuclear plants are trying to stay competitive. Every 40 seconds, someone in America has a stroke. For rural patients, getting treated quickly can be a challenge, but telemedicine is helping change that.
Oh my God, yeah, I would have died.
We'll have more on that story, and an update on how Governor Rauner's administration handled a Legionnaire's disease outbreak at the Quincy Veterans Home. That and more on Statewide. Stay tuned. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll talk with a candidate for governor of Illinois. Sam McCann is a state senator. He was elected as a Republican. Now he's running for the state's top job on the Conservative Party ticket. We'll hear why he's in the race and what he thinks are some key issues this election. Also, Jesse White is running yet again for Illinois Secretary of State for what would be his sixth term. We'll find out who's challenging him and profile that contest. It's all coming up on Statewide. We begin today taking a look at telemedicine in rural areas. 2 years ago, Donna Patton became one of the nearly 800,000 Americans who suffer a stroke each year. She still remembers the reaction from her medical team.
And he just said, "Do you believe in a higher entity?" And I said, "I sure do." He said, "Well, you should, because luck's been on your side all day long."
As Steph Whiteside reports, it wasn't just luck that was on her side, it was also technology.
Donna was the first patient in a telemedicine program designed to improve stroke treatment in smaller towns. Her story begins in 2016 at the dentist's office, where she collapsed after having her teeth cleaned.
I felt fine until I'm standing there at the counter. It couldn't have been a three-second walk. And my hands are flailing and going everywhere. So I knew I was going to collapse.
Her dentist recognized that Donna might be having a stroke. That means blood was no longer reaching all areas of her brain.
Whenever blood stops reaching an area of the brain only has a few minutes that can live without this. So the brain quickly starts dying.
Dr. Alejandro Ornick is a neurointensivist in Carbondale. Telemedicine lets him see patients who would otherwise be hours away. Any time spent reaching a stroke specialist cuts into a small window to deliver life-saving drugs. When Donna's dentist called 911, he activated the first step in the telestroke network. She was transported to Harrisburg Medical Center, a hospital with no neurologist on staff.
I can remember a television screen, and I can remember the doctors talking to whoever on the television was talking back, a guy.
That guy was Dr. Ornick.
In neurology, there is a tremendous insight that you gain by looking at the patient and seeing how the patient is doing. We examine the patients with the help of local nurses that are training how to work with us on the cameras.
Those cameras come in the form of an unassuming cart stored in the corner of a trauma room. When in use, the screen creates a video link. It's like FaceTime, but for medicine. That technology let Dr. Ornick order medication for Donna and get her airlifted to St. Louis for surgery to remove the clot, all through a video screen. Neil Atkins is the emergency room nursing director at Harrisburg. The hospital is an hour away from the nearest stroke experts, but telemedicine has changed the way they treat patients.
In the past, whenever we had a stroke patient, a lot of the mindset that we would have with it is that there's not a lot that we could do with that patient. Since then, what we've seen is there's a mindset change with early identification, early intervention.
That intervention is the use of TPA, a drug that dissolves clots in the brain to help restore blood flow.
TPA has been around for quite a while, but we would administer TPA but maybe 1 to 2 times a year. And I know last year we administered TPA 13 times.
Many parts of Illinois benefit from telestroke programs. In addition to SIH, there are programs in Springfield and Chicago. Other cities are covered by programs based in neighboring states like Wisconsin and Indiana. Dr. Sarah Song is a fellow with the American Association of Neurologists based in Chicago. She says rural and urban areas can use telemedicine to combat a shortage of neurologists.
By forming these systems of care where the smaller hospitals can work with larger hospitals and not only get the stroke expertise in the emergency room, but also come up with protocols to transfer if necessary, that really helped improve stroke care.
For patients like Donna Patton, telemedicine means being able to live after a stroke that could have led to death or permanent disability. Now in Florida, she's almost fully recovered, able to drive and live independently. That, Dr. Ornick said, is the goal for all patients, even those who aren't lucky enough to live near hospitals with a neurologist on staff.
Something amazing has to do with where you live, right? Your quality of care and your health care and your life expectancy somehow sometimes depend on where you were born and where you live. And with the access to care through telemedicine, that should not be the case anymore.
I'm Steph Whiteside, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a public media journalism collaboration covering education, politics, health, and the environment. And now we continue our look at energy in Illinois. Renewable energy is becoming increasingly important, but one older source of power is far from obsolete. Chase Cavanaugh has more on how the state's nuclear power plants are trying to stay competitive.
For some people, their first thought of a nuclear power plant involves cooling towers, meltdowns, and the comically incompetent Homer Simpson.
Don't! Who'd have thought a nuclear reactor would be so complicated?
But needless to say, The Simpsons is not an accurate representation of a nuclear power plant. Nuclear energy has a significant presence in Illinois, with 11 reactors spread across 6 plants. Together, they provide about 11.8 gigawatts of power to the entire state. That's enough for millions of homes, or almost 10 DeLorean time machines.
Great Scott!
But raw energy generated isn't the only important measurement. Paul Dempsey is a spokesman for Exelon, which owns the Byron Nuclear Generating Station. He says the plant has a capacity factor around 94%. This is a measure of the maximum amount of energy a power plant can put out, compared with how much is actually generated over a period of time.
It's a huge percentage for a large amount of power. Wind and solar are important. We definitely need a variety, but solar is in the 20% capacity factor range. Wind, maybe 35%, because we don't always have the sun, we don't always have the wind.
The turbine is in the upper floors of the plant, and at more than 1,800 RPM, it is loud. In essence, nuclear plants generate electricity at a constant rate, and don't have to worry about storing it in batteries due to inactivity. Mark Canavas is the Byron plant's site vice president. He says another advantage is that nuclear plants aren't as vulnerable to supply disruptions. In the case of the Byron plant, he says they have enough uranium on hand to keep reactors running for 18 months without an eruption.
Coal piles freeze, or coal doesn't get delivered, or railroads don't run, wind doesn't blow, sun doesn't shine. It is truly part of our national trust, is a constant supply of energy.
The supply from nuclear plants is enough to provide Illinois with 90% of its carbon-free power, and almost half of the state's overall power. But despite the output and production advantages, nuclear power faces several long-term challenges. The first is economic. Natural gas fracking and shale oil extraction have made these fuels cheap. Howard Lerner is executive director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center, an eco-business and environmental advocacy group. He says the competition from cheaper natural gas hurt the profitability of Exelon's plants in Clinton and the Quad Cities.
The fact that Exelon said they need public subsidies to the tune of about $2.5 billion tells you something about the economic competitiveness or lack thereof.
These subsidies were part of the 2016 Future Energy Jobs Act, which also included incentives for renewable energy. Building new nuclear power plants can also be a hard sell to the public. Lerner says they take about 10 years to build, but could still be a net loss in profit, even taking into account new designs.
There's a lot of R&D and technology development going on, and let's see what the engineers can produce. But what's out there right now for the new nuclear technology is not remotely economically competitive.
Canavas at the Byron plant says his facility remains profitable because it makes use of 2 reactors, which generate greater amounts of electricity. Aside from the challenge of staying profitable, nuclear plants are also dealing with the issue of storing their waste. And the problem is not what pop culture would suggest.
Rolling, rolling, rolling. Toxic barrel rolling.
They're so hot and glowing.
We'll die.
Much of the waste from a nuclear power plant is in the form of spent fuel. At a certain point, the uranium fueling a reactor won't be able to produce heat at a constant enough rate to generate power. When this happens, the fuel rods, along with other irradiated objects, need to be disposed of. Prima Chandratha with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission explains what happens to the rods.
The rods will go in and they'll be covered with this water, right? And they're there to go ahead and be, they're cooled and they're protected and they're shielding built into these spent fuel pools.
The pools are usually at least 40 feet deep, so the water contains any radiation emanating from the spent fuel. There's also enough room to store hundreds of spent fuel bundles. But Stan Campbell with the Sierra Club's Blackhawk chapter says the current problem is volume.
Each one of these nuclear power plants produces at least 33 tons of uranium dioxide waste fuel a year, not to mention all the hazardous waste that is produced because it comes in contact with the uranium dioxide fuel. That has to be dealt with.
The fuel is safe as long as it stays in these pools, but the federal government hasn't determined a central location to dispose of waste in the long run. Because of this, power plants either need to build more pools or transfer the waste into large steel and concrete cylinders called dry casks. They're stored on site outside the power station or in dedicated buildings, and while they continue to pile up, Canavas admits it's probably the best interim solution until states or the feds designate a central repository. Overall, nuclear power plants provide significant amounts of electricity in Illinois. And while they face problems with profitability and waste storage, they remain a constant source of carbon-free power that current renewables can't provide on their own. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
Now we check in with Harvest Public Media. The search for legal assistance is challenging for immigrants and migrants in rural areas. They may have to travel hundreds of miles or run into people posing as attorneys. Chad Davis explores the difficulties people in Illinois and other areas face and the solutions they might find.
On the east side of the Mississippi River is the small village of Cobden, Illinois. It's about half an hour from the college town of Carbondale. The village became a center for agriculture in the 1800s, and trains still transport crops out of the area. But the town has transitioned into a large community of southern Mexican immigrants. That's due in part to the large number of orchards bringing in farm workers. In 2010, the town's population was just over 1,000, with about 30% of its residents being of southern Mexican descent. But an unauthorized immigrant seeking a Spanish-speaking immigration lawyer might have to travel 30 minutes to Carbondale. And that's if they're lucky. Angie Gomez is the Family Services Coordinator for Su Casa Head Start in Cobden.
People have to go as far as Chicago or St. Louis to find, you know, somebody that, attorneys they've been able to communicate, you know, with them. And so can you imagine how costly that is?
The American Immigration Lawyers Association, also known as ALA, represents immigration lawyers across the U.S. Immigration lawyer Ken Schmidt is a member of ALA and the founder of St. Louis-based U.S. Legal Solutions. He says immigration lawyers will sometimes travel to rural areas to meet clients, but the majority of ALA lawyers are located in metropolitan areas, including Missouri.
If you are an immigrant in those more southeastern area, southeastern Missouri, southern Illinois, southwestern Missouri area, and some of those places have very significant Latino populations, you're traveling quite a ways to seek help.
Schmidt says the increase in demand for lawyers in urban areas makes it difficult for lawyers to travel to rural areas. And traveling can present a danger to immigrants, especially if they come across federal immigration and custom enforcement agents.
You might not be in removal proceedings. You might have a very legitimate basis for somebody to file a petition for you, and you're going to St. Louis to work on your case. you're at risk the whole way on the road to be pulled over for whatever reason and detained and possibly turned over to ICE for removal proceedings.
Schmidt says if lawyers are operating on an hourly basis, immigrants could pay up to hundreds of dollars. But the effect of not having access to credible legal representation creates another problem: fraud. The most common type? Notarios, individuals who emulate lawyers but don't necessarily have any legal background. Jennifer Ibanez Whitlock is an attorney and partner of Whitlock & Gray in St. Louis. She says in Latin America, notarios have the same responsibilities as lawyers. That often causes confusion when immigrants are seeking legal aid in the U.S.
Somebody gets their notary license, advertises themselves as such in English, and some Spanish-speaking immigrants will believe that that person somehow has some sort of legal training, but they really don't.
Whitlock, Schmidt, and many other lawyers agree the consequences of notarial fraud can be significant, including potential deportation. But Schmidt says several alternatives do exist for those with limited resources.
Places like Catholic Legal Immigration Project, like St. Francis Community Services Legal Services provides free legal services. The MICA Project provides low-cost representation or, you know, those type of places, but they have very limited resources.
For many unauthorized immigrants, the U.S. is now home. They hope the lack of access to the legal help they need won't take that away from them. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Chad Davis.
Happening this week, there was a new memorial dedicated, this one in Springfield. It's honoring state police officers killed in the line of duty. It has a wall with the names of 67 troopers. The State Police Heritage Foundation raised about $2.5 million to pay for the project. Stay with us. We'll talk politics coming up on Statewide. Back on Statewide, I'm Sean Crawford. We'll find out what's happening when it comes to social media and the governor's race in Illinois, that story ahead. And later, we will talk with the Conservative Party's candidate for governor, Sam McCann. He's a state senator who has been a Republican, but not this time. We're about a month away from the election, and there's a good chance you haven't heard a lot about the Illinois Secretary of State's race. The longtime incumbent Jesse White is back again trying for a sixth term, and for nearly 20 years he's held that position, which has consistently secured an important office for Democrats in Illinois. This campaign, the Republicans are hoping to derail White's reelection, focusing on his age and his time spent in office. For this week's Illinois Issues, Daisy Contreras speaks with Jacqueline Driscoll about the race for Secretary of State.
Now, Jacqueline, for those who don't know, what is the Secretary of State in Illinois responsible for?
The Secretary of State has a lot more responsibilities than some might think. The most notable one is the state's vehicle registration and driver licensing authority, but they also keep state records, laws, they're in charge of the state library and archives.
And who are the candidates that are still standing just a couple weeks away from the general election?
We have Democratic incumbent Jesse White. He is an 84-year-old originally from Alton. He was first elected to the office of Secretary of State in 1998. And then we have a Republican candidate, Jason Helen. He's a 42-year-old who resides in Mizzen, Illinois, and he is currently the Grundy County State's Attorney. And last, a Libertarian candidate, that is Steve Duttner. He's 41 years old. He is from Elgin, and he says he has been active in politics for roughly half his life.
And as you've been following this race, Jacqueline, there have been some issues around the Secretary of State race. What have been the biggest issues so far?
The biggest issue so far is definitely White's age. Republican candidate Jason Helen has really been hitting White very hard on his age and questioning whether he is really going to be able to serve out another four-year term. So let's take a quick listen to what Helen said when asked if it was appropriate that he was being critical of White's age.
I think it's totally appropriate in this case. The Secretary of State doesn't have the stamina to last until 2023. I think it's clear that he's wanted to retire since 2009. And if somebody wanted to retire my office 10 years ago, I would have shown them the door.
That was Republican candidate for Secretary of State Jason Helland. And now we hear from the Libertarian candidate Steve Duttner.
I think that the problem is more with like term limits because he's approaching 20 years. So I think it's very offensive and disrespectful when my Republican opponent goes after Mr. White for his age.
For the most part, Duttner has been fairly complimentary of White's tenure in the position, although he does say that he believes the Secretary of State office is, quote, a stagnant one within the past 8 years, meaning that White hasn't really accomplished anything new. As we heard, he thinks this is more of an issue about term limits. And of course, we need to hear from the current Secretary of State, Jesse White, because this whole issue is about his age. So here's what he has to say about that.
I told Mr. Holland and my Libertarian opponent that I'm in better shape than both of them.
And Jacqueline, White has also been called out over the automatic voter registration. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that is?
Definitely. So that is pretty recent. White has been called out for failing to implement the automatic voter registration program, which is essentially designed to streamline the registration process. Legislation was signed into law in 2017, and that required it to be up and running by July 1st of 2018. Some are saying only portions of that law have been implemented. In response, White's office says that this is not true. They say the program is up and running and, quote, going very well.
And do you think that White's long tenure has helped or hindered the Democratic Party in Illinois?
Well, it can be seen as both a blessing and a curse, really. If you look at the history of the office of Secretary of State, it's been used as a stepping stone to higher office, but White staying put in this position has really limited opportunities for other Democrats to build that similar name recognition that White does have throughout the state. But he's also secured a very important office for the Democratic Party since the late 1990s. And he has consistently been the highest statewide vote getter in election after election. However, this particular campaign season, the Republican Party is really hitting home this idea, this concept of career politicians, and that can definitely be seen as a negative for Jesse White in this race.
Thank you, Jacqueline.
All right, thank you, Daisy.
Jacqueline Driscoll talking with Daisy Contreras about the 2018 race for Illinois Secretary of State. And there's more information on the candidates who are running for that office. You can find those. Just go to our website, statewideshow.com. Of course, the two wealthy candidates for governor are spending a lot on advertising, whether it's on air, in print, or by mail. But there is a growing way to reach voters, and that's through social media. Peter Midland takes a look at how the campaigns have gone social.
Hey, JB. Favorite sports team?
Oh, Blackhawks, for sure.
If you live in Illinois and have been on Facebook or YouTube in the last year, chances are you've run into that JB Pritzker ad a few times. It was so pervasive at one point, Reddit threads started to pop up about it. After social media was such a lethal tool in the 2016 presidential race, it makes sense that future political campaigns would be doing whatever they could to take advantage of it. But social media and the people that use the different platforms have changed a lot even in 2 years. Instagram, Snapchat, Hulu, and Spotify, among others, have leaped into the mainstream. Facebook, however, is still the largest network of them all. It boasts billions of users, young and old, but all of these platforms are important. They have young, new audiences, many of whom can now vote and are ripe for good old-fashioned advertising. And the top two Illinois governor candidates are working overtime to win them over, to get in touch with them. A tough task for anyone, let alone two billionaires over 50. Here's an ad from Citizens for Rauner.
But this self-made businessman would go on to earn an MBA from Harvard, join an investment startup, and build a reputation as a business pioneer.
The J.B. Pritzker campaign has devoted themselves to the digital world.
Yeah, our staff is like just under a dozen people. So it's for a digital team for a statewide campaign, I would say we're probably the largest in the country, I would think.
That's the Pritzker campaign's digital director, Megan Klassen. Her team creates videos for Facebook, among other digital ads. She notes that people on different media platforms have distinct viewing habits that they have to think about. For example, making Facebook videos with dialogue you can read without sound, or creating them in a square format to be more easily viewed on mobile. Around 75% of people on Facebook use it on mobile. After several attempts to contact them, a Rauner campaign spokesman said they do not comment on ad strategy, which is a strategy in itself. Most Rauner ads are in a standard rectangular format, similar to what you'd see on YouTube or television, but there are some square-style ads, such as the notable toilet-themed anti-Pritzker ad.
Chicago's porcelain prince of tax avoidance, J.B. Pritzker.
Another tactic you'll see are ads commenting on the very experience of social media.
As governor, I'll fight for a budget that works for all Illinoisans. Swipe up to learn more.
Sorry to interrupt you watching your friend's stories. I'm J.B. Pritzker. I'm running for governor, and I'll fight to bring jobs to Illinois and grow our economy.
They also use social to let the audience get to know them. Low-stakes ads that try to paint them as relatable. Here's a Citizens for Honor ad about the governor's motorcycle jacket pins and a Pritzker one about dad jokes.
I put them on my vest and I rotate them. I have a few on now and I have several hundred back home in Springfield. And I thought I'd share a few of them with you.
All right, JB, tell us your favorite dad joke.
I mean, if I told a dad joke, everybody would break down laughing and it would ruin the shot.
But this is a heated political campaign, so negative ads must be run, but even this is new and different on social. For Governor Rauner, that extends from video and social posts to a Pritzker's ploy Tumblr blog, and even a controversial Snapchat filter depicting you in a mock-up of a mugshot of former Governor Rod Blagojevich. As for the content of most of these negative ads, it's usually one of two things. Taxes.
Budgeting for your family? Be like J.B. Pritzker and avoid paying taxes by hiding your money offshore.
Hide your money.
And Speaker Mike Madigan.
A vote for Pritzker is absolutely just basically writing a blank check to Madigan.
You know, Madigan's been in since Moby Dick was a minnow.
Pritzker's campaign has a bit of a unique strategy. They like to keep it more positive on Pritzker's page and move negative ads to a page called Rauner Failed Me. Pritzker's digital director says,
it's interesting because a lot of content that you're seeing a lot of times on Facebook generally tends to be like more positive. So I think it's kind of like jarring maybe to see a really negative clip from somebody that's like a person.
You can see on Facebook that the ad was paid for by JB for governor. They just don't want the negative ad sitting next to his face. As Election Day draws closer and closer and the race gets more heated, no matter where you are online, expect your timeline to be flush with ads. I'm Peter Medlin.
You're listening to Statewide. Public station WBEZ in Chicago has learned that Governor Bruce Rauner's office contributed to a decision in 2015 to delay notifying the public about an outbreak of the deadly Legionnaire's disease. That information comes from newly obtained documents. 12 residents at the state-run veterans home in Quincy ended up dying as a result of the outbreak. Dozens more were sickened, and there were more outbreaks at the home in 2016 and 2017. Dave McKinney and Tony Arnold have been investigating the story for a year now, and Dave starts off the latest update.
At the end of August 2015, the first outbreak of Legionnaire's disease at the Quincy Veterans Home was ramping up. One resident had already died, and more were getting sick and being taken to the hospital. But a document we recently uncovered shows Governor Rauner's press office wanted to hold off telling the public about that. In an email dated August 25, 2015, Rauner's press secretary, Lindsay Walters, writes the state's public health director. She tells him to hold off on sending a press release about the impending outbreak. She writes, quote, "I do not think we need to issue a statement to the media. Let's hold and see if we receive any reporter inquiries." Well, the press release comes out 2 days later, contributing to the delay in public notification at an important point in the crisis. Nirav Shah, Rauner's public health director, has repeatedly said he waited to tell the public about the outbreak to make sure he had all the information needed to assess the situation and not incite a panic. But this email from Walters telling him to delay shows no pushback from Shaw. Walters now works in the press office for President Trump. She wouldn't answer WBEZ's specific questions.
And Dave, I'll pick up the story here. This is Tony Arnold.
Legionnaire's disease comes from a bacteria in the water. It's treatable with antibiotics. And this email from Lindsay Walters is one of almost 50,000 documents the state turned over to WBEZ through an open records request. Many of those documents are partially, if not wholly, redacted or blacked out. But from what we can see, these documents show a pattern of a slow or incomplete response by the Rauner administration to the outbreaks. In some emails, there are concerns about the lack of transparency surrounding the 2015 outbreak. One shows even the chaplain on the Quincy campus says he's heard all sorts of rumors and misinformation as to what's being done. In other emails, the union representing the staff raises concerns about how they don't know what's going on. The union rep asked for more information, and when this is presented to Shaw, the public health director writes, quote, "Weighing in here is not our job." Shaw suggests passing the request off to the governor's office or another agency. One expert says whether it's telling the public or the union, what matters is that the state be open about every new Legionnaire's case.
The better, the more aggressive and open you are about this, the more likely you are to render that place safe.
Himesh Adalja is an infectious disease expert at Johns Hopkins.
When you're dealing with an infectious disease emergency, it's really important that politicians stay in their lane and let public health and infectious disease professionals manage the outbreak.
So, Tony, in 2016, there's another outbreak at the Veterans Home. Five people are diagnosed with Legionnaires that year. Governor Rauner holds a press conference declaring his administration is on top of the situation. 2 months later, there's a meeting of the whole staff at the Veterans Home. Troy Culbertson had recently taken over as the home administrator, and a memo shows that he tells staff nobody's hiding information. The memo says, quote, "What we say and how we say it is very important. There's a responsibility to public safety, to economic development in the Quincy area, and tourism. These are issues that go beyond our scope." We asked Rauner's office what role tourism plays and how staff is notified about safe water. A spokesman didn't say, but wrote back, quote, "His comments seem obvious to ask all his staff to be aware of their words as they could be interpreted in many different ways. Mr. Culbertson clearly stated to staff that no one was hiding information." But as the summer goes on, test results show the home is consistently getting positive hits for the Legionella bacteria in the water system.
The next year, Dave, in 2017, different residents test positive for Legionnaire's disease in March, May, and September, but the public is not told about those instances until December, after WBEZ asks. Now, the state does publicize an outbreak in the fall, 5 days after Korean War veteran Valdemar Dean died. But Rauner's administration does not send out a press release to notify families. Instead, they make a few calls to the reporters around Quincy to let them know. A Rauner spokeswoman says, quote, "Our focus from the beginning has been caring for our veterans and ensuring their safety. We have regularly communicated with residents, staff, family members, and the general public throughout the past 3 years." But Democratic State Representative Stephanie Kifowit thinks state officials were willfully neglectful.
All aspects of this needs to be looked at through the criminal process, whether it be manslaughter, neglect, you name it.
Well, Kifowit helped change state law, so the state can't legally wait several days to tell the public of an outbreak anymore. The new law mandates public health officials publicize an outbreak in a veteran's home within 24 hours of realizing it. Rauner himself signed it into law. But even with the new laws, Rauner's administration continues to defend its handling of the outbreaks. In fact, documents show Nirav Shah, the state's public health director, thought his handling of the deadly 2015 outbreak was one of his greatest accomplishments for the year. At the time, a high-ranking Rauner aide had asked every agency director to list their top achievements of 2015. Shaw writes that his agency successfully navigated the Legionnaires outbreak in which 12 residents died, and that it could have, quote, "spiraled out of control were it not for the decisive, coordinated response led by IDPH. Shaw writes, "In public health, we often claim credit for the bullets that we dodge." I'm Dave McKinney.
And I'm Tony Arnold.
News also coming this week that the Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan's office has opened a criminal investigation of the Rauner administration, investigating whether any laws were violated in response to the Legionnaire's disease outbreaks in Quincy. A spokesperson for the Democrat Attorney General would not say who's the target of the criminal investigation or when it began. Madigan's spokesperson denying the timing of the announcement as political, considering that Rauner faces re-election next month. She did say the investigation is looking at whether the residents, staff, and public were informed in a timely and appropriate manner. Well, Governor Rauner's opponent, J.B. Pritzker, got some negative press this week as well. A new report has found that Pritzker, the Democratic nominee for governor, engaged in a scheme to defraud taxpayers. And that's prompting calls for an investigation from his Republican rivals. Governor Rauner has been poking fun of Pritzker for removing toilets from a mansion he owns to get a property tax break. The Chicago Sun-Times first reported that the independent Cook County Inspector General investigated and found Pritzker's actions saved him about $330,000. But Pritzker has told reporters nothing was improper, and removing the toilets was part of a renovation. He has agreed to pay back the money in question. Well, just ahead, one of the other candidates for governor, the Conservative Party's Sam McCann, will sit down with us. That's coming up on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. And a reminder, you can follow us each week on our website, statewideshow.com. Past shows are available there. Well, we found out a bit more this week about the impact that video gambling is having on the state's casinos. The video machines continue to draw people away from the riverboats. That's according to a new report from the Illinois Legislature's Nonpartisan Budget Commission. But some state lawmakers are still pushing for an expansion of gambling. The state Senator Dave Severson, a Rockford Republican, says there is still a market for casinos and a need for the extra tax money.
Whether it's Chicago or Rockford, or Danville, they're still viable, and they're going to generate jobs and revenue.
Meanwhile, the video terminals have exploded in popularity, with more than 29,000 appearing in restaurants, truck stops, and strip malls across Illinois. The report says that number is the equivalent of 24 new riverboat casinos. Last week, we heard from the Libertarian nominee for governor, Cash Jackson. There is another candidate on the ticket under a third-party banner, the state senator Sam McCann of the self-established Conservative Party. He sat down with our Rachel Otwell to talk more about his platform, as well as his contentious relationship with the Republican governor, Bruce Rauner.
We know that Jeannie Ives lost the Republican primary. She is a state representative, but she came within a single digit percentage points to winning the Republican primary, which was much closer than many had anticipated. She was outspoken as a social conservative, something you're also identifying as. How does her near success in your campaign speak to a divide in the Republican Party in Illinois?
I think there's obviously a divide in the Republican Party that showcases it perfectly, and I think anyone in the Republican Party realized it before that and realizes it now. Governor Rauner unfortunately decided to purchase a party prior to running for governor in 2014. He had historically voted as a Democrat, but he knew that the Democratic Party was probably too strong in Illinois to purchase outrightly. So he decided to buy the Republican Party because he knew he could buy it at a fire sale price. And what that's done, though, is it's divided the party even further. The Republican Party was just starting to get its sea legs when he came along, and now this deep division is going to make the Republican Party even weaker. But that being said, that's one of the reasons I decided to run as a third party, forming the new Conservative Party, is because I have been there for nearly 8 years. When I ran in 2010, I term limited myself. I said I would serve no more than 8 to 10 years in the Senate, and at the end of this term will be 8 years. So I'm a man of my word. I'm term limiting myself. And I have been there for nearly 8 years, and I can tell you with firsthand knowledge that neither party really cares all that much about the people of Illinois. Each party exists for the same reason, and that is to amass more and more power, amass it and retain it for the sake of party power and not for the sake of giving the power to the people.
You and the governor have had a storied relationship. Mostly, of course, it's been contentious. He spent some $3 million in efforts to unseat you in 2016. Anyone watching the first televised debate could hear the tension between you two. Why do you believe your relationship with the governor in particular has been so contentious, and why do you believe you've been targeted?
Well, I think it boils down to I've stood up for conservative values, this social and fiscal conservative values. So on the fiscal side, the stalemate, the budget stalemate, the state of Illinois not having a budget, a state budget for 2 years, that was not fiscally prudent. We actually spent over $1 billion, that's with a B, $1 billion in finance charges and interest. That's money out the window. That's money to creditors for late fees. Those dollars could have been used to pave roads, build bridges, keep social services flowing. We've had a ton of dental practices close up as a result of those of the stalemate, the budget stalemate. So whether it's fiscal or social, the governor is no Republican, is no conservative. And so I think our disagreements over the years stems from the fact that he's in the wrong party.
Governor Rauner claims that you are a pawn used by House Speaker Mike Madigan, a Democrat. And third-party candidates are often criticized for the so-called stealing of votes. Governor Rauner seems to think that is your sole function in this election.
First and foremost, that's an outright lie on his part, and he knows it. I'm in this to win it. I'm not being financed or backed by Mike Madigan or the Democrats. I don't know Mike Madigan. I've met the man twice that I recall. Both times we had conversations where we both left holding true to our beliefs. I tried to convince him to see it my way. He tried to convince me to see it his way. We both ended up leaving those two brief meetings believing what we believed when we walked in. I held to my beliefs. He held to his beliefs. I really don't know the man. It's been several years since I've even spoken to him. And again, I've only spoken to him twice that I can recall. That being said, I know, and that one of the reasons I didn't run in the primary is that I know that the only way a conservative, a downstate conservative, is going to win the governorship of Illinois is in a situation that we have right now. This is a perfect storm for a downstate conservative to become the next governor of Illinois. If I would have won in the primary, I would have had to have faced a very strong Democratic nominee. As a downstate white male conservative, it would have been difficult to have won that race, especially in this blue wave year. In the paradigm that we have created, we have a four-way race. I think it's essentially a three-way race, but technically a four-way race. And I really believe that instead of having to run to the middle, we're going to be able to run on what we believe and what we proudly believe. And I believe that the first person to get to 34, 35, 36% is going to be the next governor of Illinois. And I know from looking at the polling that both the Democrat and the Republican have high negatives. They have very low positives. The people of Illinois are looking for a solution. They're looking for something outside the box, and I believe that's us. We will bring leadership to the state of Illinois, and that's what the state needs. It needs a leader, not another politician.
I'm Rachel Otwell, and I'm speaking with candidate for Illinois Governor State Senator Sam McCann. He's running under the banner of the Conservative Party. More broadly, what are some of the top issues facing the state right now that you're most concerned with?
I think that number one top issue that faces the state of Illinois today is that it's controlled by the two major parties, and the two major parties each seek to win the next election and amass that power. Neither one of them really sees the value in leadership. They want to. They are in this to win the next election, not to make the next generation stronger. And because they are both in it to amass that power, there's no reason for them to work with one another. So I believe that the number one issue facing the state is this gridlock between the two parties. And that's one of the reasons I'm running, and running as a third party, is because I'm not going to go there to necessarily just get reelected or to amass power for one major party or the other. It will be to bring people together and move forward with consensus, but from a conservative viewpoint.
And so when it comes to the party you've established, the Conservative Party, tell us a little bit more about how you decided to to start that and what exactly your major platforms are?
Yeah, so I would say that for anyone who identifies as a conservative, they know exactly where we're coming from, and that is many people in Illinois and across the country identify as conservative, and they say that they're Republicans because they're conservative, and the Republican Party is the closest thing to their values and viewpoints. And so it's interesting that the Republican Party has a platform, the Democratic Party has a platform. The problem is that the Republican Party keeps electing people in Illinois. I'm talking about here in the state of Illinois. The Republican Party keeps electing people who don't pay attention to the platform. They either ignore it, or they try to cover it up, or they run from it, or they try to change it. So the Conservative Party of Illinois would be simply copy and paste the Republican platform. That would be our platform. The difference is we believe in it, we stand for it, we stand on it, and we run on it. We're proud of it.
Governor Rauner has been not quick to speak for or against positions that President Donald Trump has. Would you be willing to speak outright for or against the president? Would you want to work closer with the federal government compared to Rauner?
Yeah. First and foremost, I proudly voted for Donald Trump for president. I supported him vocally and verbally in his election efforts. I voted for him on Election Day, not because he's a perfect person. He's not perfect. I'm not perfect. You're not perfect. None of us are perfect. But the principles and the values that he stands for are something that are the principles and values that will rebuild the country and will help rebuild this state. So I look forward to being elected on November 6th and working in concert with President Trump and his administration to make Illinois stronger. And one of the ways that we can do that, and where both parties, all parties, can sit at the table together with the president and his administration, would be with a capital bill, with an infrastructure plan. There's no way that we can address the hundreds of billions of dollars of infrastructure needs that need to be dealt with in Illinois without partnering with the federal government. So I look forward to on day one, and I will be prepared to lead on day one. I am prepared and will be prepared. I'll work in concert with the congressional delegation from Illinois and the Trump administration to get a handle on the violence in Chicago and around the state, and to get a handle on our infrastructure needs, and to work together. Both Pritzker and Rauner claim that they don't want to work with the president. Rauner has essentially ran from the president, and Pritzker denounces him. How can the people of Illinois expect to get what's due them? How can we expect to have a full seat at the table when we have a governor who refuses to work with the president of the United States? I look forward to working with President Trump, and we will get things done.
So some voters may be concerned about certain aspects of your past, including campaign funds used for travel. In early 2016, there was a complaint filed with the Illinois State Board of Elections claiming that you had given yourself too much money from your campaign for mileage reimbursement. And then back about a year ago, a similar issue came up regarding your purchasing of a certain vehicle for a little over $60,000. What's your take on those critiques?
Well, we unfortunately live in times where people are more concerned about winning elections than leading, and you're always going to have critics. And so the way I've been able to win all three previous elections, I started running in the 10 election cycle. We won in 2010, 2012, and 2016 for the state Senate. I ran against a lady who she and her husband had held the seat before me for nearly 40 years. They had all the power, all the name ID, all the money, all the endorsements, all the recognition, and people said we couldn't win, and we did. And the way we won in 2010 against all of that was by being out there, boots on the ground, 7 days a week with the people, and the people knew it. It didn't matter what the commercial said. It didn't matter what my opponent said. They knew it because they had met me. They had seen me. 2012, we faced a bitter primary, and in 2016, an even more bitter primary. And again, we won those being outspent, outmaneuvered in all of the traditional political ways, but because we were constantly 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, boots on the ground, going to events, attending events all over the district, all over the state, people knew better than to listen to that nonsense. So that complaint that you're talking about was totally dismissed as frivolous by the State Board of Elections, totally dismissed. They realized that it was nothing more than a political ploy. And when it comes to that vehicle that was bought, that wasn't bought for me. I didn't. I used campaign funds to buy the vehicle, but not for myself. That belongs to the campaign. And so when the day comes that I'm no longer serving in political office, or I'm no longer running for political office, that vehicle will be put on the auction block, sold at auction, and those funds will be returned to the campaign fund and disposed of per the rules at the State Board of Elections. So there's nothing wrong with it. It's just political maneuvering by political opposition to try to paint a black cloud over us. We're proud of the fact. I'm very proud of the fact that I campaign in the style that I campaign in, and that is while my opponents are sitting back coming up with these weird accusations like this, I'm out there meeting people, answering the tough questions, and the people have rewarded me with victory three times.
That's Sam McCann. He's running for Illinois governor on the Conservative Party ticket. He spoke with Rachel Otwell. Last week, we heard from the Libertarian nominee Cash Jackson, and we have also offered up opportunities for both the Republican and Democratic nominees to sit down with us here on Statewide. And that does it for this week's show. Be sure to tune in next time for another Statewide. We'll hear more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Be sure to check out the website, statewideshow.com. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other public radio stations.